From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The storm is intensifying and is still pointed toward New Orleans, and it's not a meteorologist or an expert that I have talked to that says that this storm will not impact New Orleans in a major way. As a result of that, I am this morning declaring that we will be doing a mandatory evacuation.
That was then Mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, as he announced the mandatory evacuation of his city hours before landfall of Hurricane Katrina.
A mandatory evacuation order is hereby called for all of the parish of Orleans, with only the following exceptions: essential personnel of the United States of America, State of Louisiana, and City of New Orleans, essential personnel of regulated utilities and mass transportation services, essential personnel of hospitals and their patients, essential personnel of the media, essential personnel of the Orleans Parish Criminal Sheriff's Office and its inmates, and the essential personnel of operating hotels and their patrons. Unless covered by one of the aforementioned exceptions, every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the City of New Orleans, or, if no other alternative is available, to immediately move to one of the facilities within the city that will be designated as a refuge of last resort. Point two, in order to effectuate the mandatory evacuation at the direction of the mayor, the city, the chief administrative officer, the director of Homeland Security for the City of New Orleans, or any member of the New Orleans Police Department, the city may commandeer any private property included but not limited to buildings that may be designated as refuge of last resort, and vehicles that may be used to transport people out of the area.
After issuing the order, Nagin described in part the horrors to come, as well as the city's planned response.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish I had better news for you, but we are facing a storm that most of us have feared. I do not want to create panic, but I do want the citizens to understand that this is very serious and it's of the highest nature, and that's why we're taking this unprecedented move. The storm is now a Cat 5, a Category 5, as I appreciate it, with sustained winds of 150 miles an hour, with wind gusts of 190 miles per hour. The storm surge most likely will topple our levee system, so we are preparing to deal with that also. So that's why we're ordering a mandatory evacuation. This morning, the Superdome is already open for people with special needs. If you have a medical condition, if you're on dialysis or some other condition, we want you to expeditiously move to the Superdome. At noon today, the Superdome will then be opened up as a refuge of last resort, where we will start to take citizens that cannot evacuate. But let me emphasize, the first choice for every citizen is to figure out a way to leave the city. And I'm asking all the churches, we sent out a fax to all the churches that we could this morning, basically alerting them exactly what we're doing and asking them to buddy up, to find members in their congregations, to check on a senior citizen or a citizen who may not have the means and is totally relying upon public transportation to get around.
New Orleans had seen hurricanes before, and the possibility of a storm like Katrina had been long acknowledged by emergency management officials. Nevertheless, the city, state, and federal emergency response apparatus failed, and there were many lives lost as a consequence. Sitting at the top of the emergency response management team was Michael Chertoff, who, as head of the Department of Homeland Security, was in charge of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which was charged with the oversight and much of the implementation of the emergency response. Before the waters had fully receded, Chertoff faced a congressional committee called by Republicans in the House that was boycotted by House Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and most of her delegation. There was one Democratic House member, however, who not only attended, but took a central role in the hearings and, in particular, in grilling Chertoff about his failures and those of the Bush administration's top officials. That was then Georgia Democratic Representative Cynthia McKinney. McKinney had a number of questions about various contracts that had been handed out by FEMA to some of the same firms that had been getting favorable treatment from the White House as vendors in the Iraq War. She ended her questioning of Chertoff by asking who was responsible for the failures by officials which resulted in the deaths of thousands and the displacement of more than 100,000 people.
On the day Katrina made landfall, our president made two Medicare appearances. 2 days later, Condoleezza Rice took in a play and bought shoes while thousands were homeless. The vice president, we're told, was fishing while New Orleans flooded. And you, Mr. Secretary, reports tell us that you were confused about your role. Now, we're also told that the National Response Plan, which placed you in charge, wasn't followed by you. And as a result, we got the following headlines, which I compiled. FEMA won't accept Amtrak's help in evacuations. FEMA turns away experienced firefighters. FEMA turns back Walmart supply trucks. FEMA prevents Coast Guard from delivering diesel fuel. Homeland Security won't let Red Cross deliver food. FEMA bars morticians from entering New Orleans. FEMA blocks 500-boat citizen flotilla from delivering aid. FEMA fails to utilize Navy ship with 600-bed hospital on board. FEMA to Chicago, send just one truck. FEMA turns away generators. FEMA, first responders urged not to respond. Those are just a few of the headlines that I collected. Now, I also read with interest a New Orleans headline that says nursing home owners charged in deaths. The owners of a St. Bernard Parish nursing home, where 34 residents died during Hurricane Katrina, were arrested Tuesday and booked with negligent homicide. Mr. Secretary, if the nursing home owners are arrested for negligent homicide, why shouldn't you also be arrested for negligent homicide?
Chertoff's answer did not address the question of criminal liability.
I can tell you that the president was deeply and personally engaged in this process from before the hurricane. I was deeply and personally engaged in the process from before the hurricane. I think everybody understood this was a very dangerous, catastrophic storm when it was coming on. Nobody could have watched the images or heard the anecdotes of what was going on without having a heart-wrenching experience. And I can tell you certainly it's horrible to contemplate people who have already lost loved ones, homes, livelihoods, who are obviously devastated, to reflect that those people are not getting promptly moved out of where they are and placed into shelter and given adequate medical attention. It was enormously frustrating to me. I became angry sometimes. I certainly, as the hours rolled on between Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, I pushed harder and harder about why things weren't moving. I still don't know the full story about why some things didn't move, and I will look forward to hearing the answer to that.
When we spoke with her via Skype Friday, former Representative McKinney, now Dr. McKinney, told us that 10 years after querying Chertoff, she still has yet to receive a direct answer to her question about official responsibility for the multiple failures, or worse, leading to the deaths of thousands and the displacement of about 20% of the city's population, mostly from New Orleans' black community. But she also told us how it came to be that she was one of the only Democratic members of Congress to join the investigation into the Bush administration's gross and multiple failures in the government's Katrina response.
There could have been 40 others.
Wow.
Because I went to every member of the Congressional Black Caucus and begged them to participate in the hearings. Tom Davis had offered a budget for the Democrats if they participated in the hearings. And it was several million dollars of budget that all we needed to do was participate in the hearings and do our research, do our own investigation, produce our investigative report, which would have been a part of the official congressional report on the failures of the U.S. government as it related to its preparation, its evacuation, and the aftermath of both hurricanes, Katrina and Rita. And the members of the Congressional Black Caucus refused to buck the Democratic leadership's mandate to stay away from the committee. And so I had one very honest Congressional Black Caucus member to tell me, well, Cynthia, you just have to understand that when the leadership says don't do something, we're not going to do it.
You essentially made the case for and then asked the Director of Homeland Security, did you not commit, in essence, in your negligence, which is well documented, criminally negligent homicide with the dead people in New Orleans? Why would Pelosi not want to participate in this hearing, since it was a Republican president?
I think that there was deep state politics that was involved. You had people like Donald Trump, who were already on scene buying up land in New Orleans and, to build. I don't even know if the structures were ever built, but, you know, they were supposed to build the high rises. And so there were huge real estate deals that were coming on the heels of the tragedy. And those deals were not to be interfered with. And of course, if the Democrats that were it was Democrats that were mainly affected. And by that, I mean, it was black people. And if the Democratic Party allowed investigations of what was actually going on and the insurance, the failure of insurance companies to come forward. And, you know, if there was an investigation, a properly run investigation, it would have gotten in the way of the hidden politics of which the leadership of the Democratic Party was a part. And I say that because why else would Nancy Pelosi say don't participate? Why else, when you've got your major constituency that has been negatively affected by the incompetence or worse of a Republican administration, would you sit back and say, okay, we're going to just, you know, ride this out and let this happen and, you know, see how fate turns it?
You know,
that was basically the attitude.
And along those lines, the Democratic Party is notorious, really, for, on the one hand, commanding the allegiance of black voters overwhelmingly, and on the other hand, not really since 1965, actually doing anything for black people, and in a lot of cases, like Clinton's administration, doing things to black people.
Yeah, it's a relationship that's like, you know, domestic violence. Mm. And at some point, you would think that the spouse who's being beaten up would say, hey, wait a minute, I have more dignity and more self-respect than to stay in this kind of relationship. The spouses that end up staying in these relationships are the ones who have low self-esteem or no self-esteem and who have allowed their dignity to be totally and thoroughly stripped from them.
So taking the mindset of the sociopath in that relationship, of the abuser, and say, assuming that that's the mindset of the Democratic Party, you know, consciously, why would they not take advantage of the ability to crucify the Bush administration over a racial issue that would mean that they could command the allegiance of black people for another 10 years without ever doing another damn thing for them, where it seems to have no cost to them?
Well, you know, why do anything when you have to do nothing?
Right.
You know, so by doing something, you inflame the passions of the what they call the swing white voter that you're trying to attract. And so you get the black vote for free. So you don't really need to spend any of your political capital because it's already a part of the it's a part of the democratic infrastructure that comes free of charge.
Yeah. And then I'm wondering, I don't know if you have these, certainly you don't have these at your fingertips. But, you know, we know that the population of New Orleans when Katrina hit was just shy of 500,000. It was 496 something. And then it went all the way down up to, in 2010, it was at 343,000. Now it's gone up 11.5%, almost 12% since then to 384. A lot of folks got scattered. I'm wondering if where they landed, if there was a demographic shift that somehow translated into some benefit for Democratic, you know, congressional representation, et cetera. Do you know if that, if there was that kind of a, you know, like the folks that came to Georgia, for example, did they settle in marginal districts that suddenly swung Democratic, or did they end up concentrated where there was already a Democratic base?
At least in Georgia, they ended up going to areas that were already Democratic. And now, of course, we know that there were some people who were as far flung from Louisiana as Utah. The demographics of Louisiana politics is what has significantly changed. And of course, we now have a Republican governor,
right,
in Louisiana as a result.
Yeah, so.
You also have a demographic shift inside the city of New Orleans as well, where the black middle class, I just posted something on my Facebook page, Cynthia McKinney Official, about the black middle class having been washed away. And the influx was of the white professional urban person,
yeah,
moved into New Orleans. And that is the key demographic shift. It's reflected in the composition of the city council, and it's also been reflected in, now, of course, you have the Republican governor.
The treatment of New Orleans' black population by the government should have been no surprise to any student of history, given the record of such abuse from the city's inception. For more on that, we spoke Friday via Skype with Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston.
I still continue to believe that one of the most stunning facts of recent U.S. political history is the point that David Duke, an avowed Ku Klux Klansman and Nazi Party leader, got 55% of the Euro-American vote in running for governor in 1991. By the way, he just endorsed GOP presidential aspirant Donald Trump, although Mr. Trump has rejected his endorsement. You should also know that during the bad old days of slavery, Louisiana probably had a higher rate of slave revolts than any other state in Dixie. And that includes the epical attempted revolt of 1811, led, by the way, by black people who had recently come to Louisiana with their so-called masters fleeing the Haitian Revolution. So Louisiana, in many ways, portrayed itself in a character in a way that was consistent with its history in 2005. It's often said that individuals and or societies revealed their true character when under stress. By that measure, Louisiana exposed itself for the racist state that it is.
It's interesting that you mentioned both the, you know, the origins of the city, or in any event, the early history of the city with the people, the slavers that were fleeing the Haitian Revolution, bringing the people that, you know, that were that they had enslaved with them, those being at the source of the resistance shortly thereafter, and Donald Trump, all in the same sentence or paragraph, because Donald Trump, in fact, was one of the people that was part of the wave of lawyers, developers, and brokers that came in right behind the waves of Katrina to try to steal the city from, successfully stealing the city from better than 100,000 of its residents who still remain in exile.
You may recall that former chief of staff to U.S. President Barack Obama, I'm speaking of the current mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, oftentimes spoke of not letting a crisis go to waste. Certainly, that has been an animating spirit of those who have sought to exploit post-Katrina Louisiana. It's not only the rapacious developers, so-called, like one Donald Trump, who have been plucking the carcass of New Orleans, but it's also the fact that the local authorities chose the opportunity to do a massive counterattack against teachers' unions and against public schools in an attempt to set up New Orleans as a kind of model for what might befall public education systems across the country. And of course, the picture has not been pretty.
You're in Houston, right? And there were a number of people from New Orleans and elsewhere, but particularly New Orleans, that ended up resettling there. Are you familiar with what their condition is now?
Well, yes, I am. You may also recall that in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where simultaneously you had countless numbers of black people living in the Superdome, the football stadium in New Orleans, with then many of them moving to a like facility in Houston, you had the spectacle of former First Lady Barbara Bush talking about how supposedly they were doing quite well. Well, this was a gross overstatement at best. Although it is fair to say that thousands upon thousands of former residents of New Orleans have found a home in Houston, but I'm afraid to say that their plight has hardly improved despite the fact that they have found sanctuary in Texas.
Most of us outside of Texas, certainly, and even outside of the South, are unfamiliar with the political conditions in Houston and in Texas. Could you give us a brief description of that?
Well, you may know that for about two decades, the Republican Party has won virtually every statewide office in the state of Texas. That includes the recent gubernatorial race, where Greg Abbott won, succeeding Rick the Hairdo Perry, who is now running for U.S. president, although I dare say not for long. To give you an idea of the depths of right-wing sentiment in the state of Texas, Greg Abbott, who happens to be Catholic, was recently excoriated for saying some nice things about his religion on his Facebook page. it seems that the Protestant fundamentalists thought that this was a bridge too far, a step too far, and now Greg Abbott is in hot water simply because of saying some nice things about Roman Catholicism. This is the kind of backwards medieval politics that you have in the state of Texas.
You mentioned the assault on the teachers' union in New Orleans. And also, though, there has been quite a switch from public education to charter schools and just outright privatization of the educational system in New Orleans. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. As you know, this is part of a national trend. Recall that Rupert Murdoch, the Australian-American billionaire who controls the New York Post and Fox News, recruited former New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein, who, by the way, before he became New York City Schools Chancellor, had little experience in education, which shows you the kind of disrespect that this important field is accorded. And the attempt to get Joel Klein on the payroll of Rupert Murdoch was also an attempt to force through a number of charter school so-called reforms across the country. You may also recall that Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire founder of Facebook, gave millions of dollars to the New York City, the Newark, New Jersey public school system. The purpose, according to then Mayor Cory Booker, was to gut the public education system and replace it with charter schools. Governor Chris Christie thought the purpose should be to destroy the teachers' union. That idea, that dual idea of destroying teachers' unions and replacing public education with charter schools, has basically attained a kind of zenith in the city of New Orleans post-Katrina. And, of course, the children have been the major victims.
Yeah, that dual punch is a remarkable exhibition of neoliberal economics. You have essentially someone creating a new labor market as they enter it, privatizing formerly government functions.
I'm also afraid to say that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been a bit too favorable for my taste to charter schools. And one would think that the U.S. ruling elite is not thinking clearly and not thinking carefully. Because if they are to compete in a global economy, the U.S. labor force, one would think, would have to be well-educated. But on more sober reflection, I assume that their feeling is that the growing robotization of the U.S. economy might not require so many human laborers. And in any case, with the scientific and technological revolution and the fact that if your work product can be digitized, be you an architect or reading x-rays or even preparing legal briefs, that means that you're in competition with workers all over the world. And thus, it might be useful for U.S. corporate entities to not necessarily employ U.S. workers who might demand higher wages and unionization, and instead try to go to developing countries to hire those workers under repressive regimes and autocratic regimes to do similar labor. This is the kind of whiplash that the U.S. labor force is being subjected to, particularly in the post-Katrina era.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.